Back here in Waco, a number of changes occurred during World War I. Now, you mentioned that you were down there for a summer in 1919. What do you recall of the changes that the war brought in the town of Waco?
Well, of course, the war brought the camp, Camp MacArthur. And that was the thing that really changed the face of and the spirit of Waco, I think. They built that camp, built it very rapidly. I was working with the engineers in those days. I got a job at $2 a day and thought that I was getting extremely rich at the thing.
You were working doing what?
Well, I drove the first stake that was ever driven out from Richfield, which is now the area where Richfield High School and that part of town, but the airfield was there. And I was driving stakes, carrying a chain, surveyor's chain, or stadia rods. With the engineers, we laid off. I was not there when we laid off the first part of the camp. I was in school, but the coming summer I was working with the engineers, as I say it, at $2 a day and surveying all around. They did all kind of surveying and all kind of work with level. I got to inspecting sewer pipe. I handled 200 carloads of sewer pipe out there. I don't know why they gave me the job, but the engineers put me to it. In those days, you took, I'd unload that pipe off of the cars, and I stood there with a stick, and it hit each joint of pipe as it came off. And you could tell by the sound whether there was a crack in it or not. And that's what I was doing, and that took a whole lot of my time. When I wasn't actually out with a surveying party, that's what I was doing, was testing that sewer pipe. That lasted pretty well all summer.
What else did you observe in terms of the changes that Richfield and Camp MacArthur brought? You, a few minutes ago, said that it changed Waco greatly.
Well, a business, of course, boomed here. A lot of construction went on, and lots of new people moved in. And you didn't, Waco ceased to be the kind of country county seat that it was before, and I guess you'd say it became more of a city.
How'd your family feel about that?
Well, they didn't want it. They didn't, of course, they didn't like it. And felt they were better off not to have it. And would have much preferred not to have had the fort here, but they realized they had to have them somewhere. And there wasn't any real complaint about it. Either my family or very many others. Most people accepted it much better, I think, then than they accept those kind of things now. They recognize that the nation was at war and that we had to make these adjustments if we were going to win it. And, of course, we were fighting that war to win it, unlike the Vietnamese War. We did everything we could to win it, and almost everybody. There were a few people who felt friendly with Germany, generally of German descent. There were some of those, and of course at that time...
How many German Americans and people interested in Central Europe were there in the Waco area that you knew about?
Quite a number, down toward Riesel and Westphalia and areas of that kind. And many of those people felt that we weren't being neutral even before we got into the war. And, of course, I think that those of us who look back know we were not very neutral. The United States pretty well sided with the Allies from the very beginning, and that we did take a good many stands that that weren't just even-handed as between the contestants, because we wanted to see the Allies win.
Some of these things were discussed in your family then?
Oh, yes, they were, yes. Although our family was all for the Allies, and all for the war, and, I mean, for the American entrance to the war. When that came along, when, well, it is that same summer that we were talking about, I graduated from high school.
Let's say we entered the war in April of 1917.
17, yes. And I graduated from high school the next year. I was 17 years old when we entered. Then when I graduated, I tried to get in the Navy. I was one of those who thought I wanted to sail the seas, and they turned me down on colorblindness. In those days, the tests were given by yarns. They had 144 different yarns that they put in the box. They'd pull one out and say, "What's this color?" Or they'd tell you, "Pick out the greens." That sort of thing. Well, I couldn't, and I still am, of course, red-green colorblind. I guess that's the most common kind of colorblindness. I couldn't pick them out. They turned me down, and then I got to work with these engineers. But as fall came along, obviously I knew I ought to be doing something, and I finally succeeded in really just memorizing that box of yarns. You'd get to where you'd get acquainted with them. You'd know what this is just by looking at it, regardless of the color of it. And at last I could pass his examination. Of course, the recruiting officer let me hang around there. And I at last passed his examination along in the fall of the year and came here to Baylor as attached to the SATC, but actually as a member of the Navy. Because the Navy had about 30 midshipmen up here who were attached to the Army Training Corps for training. And we lived down there at old Cowden Hall down Fifth Street, which is now the education building of the First Baptist Church there. But they had Cowden Maggie Houston Hall, which was the original Baylor University in Waco. And I spent the fall living there. It was 8 men in a room there, and we had a coal stove to keep us warm right in the middle of it. We slept on cots around it.
How eager were you young men to get into the war per se?
I wasn't eager. I wasn't a bit eager, but I felt that it was up to us to win that war, and we had to do it. I mean, I didn't get into it because I felt that it was something that it was going to be an enjoyable lark at all. Some of them were. Some of them, I must say, looked forward to it. I never did. In fact, I was, I won't say reluctant, because I didn't have to get into it then. Wasn't drafted, but then I just felt that we should get into it.
Mr. Pogue, my associate, Mr. Philip Thompson, would like to ask a question.
Certainly.
In November of 1916, Woodrow Wilson campaigned as president, as the president who kept us out of war. And then 5 months later, here he is declaring war. How much of a psychological adjustment was that for people in Central Texas to go from neutrality to a wartime?
I don't recall that it had, that they looked upon it as the great change that we now look upon it. Because, of course, Mr. Wilson pointed to the German submarine campaign, the people resented the German campaign, and I think the people were right along with the president on that. They wanted to stay out of the war, and in the first 2 years of the war, we were always hoping that it would come to an end and so on, but it hadn't, and the Germans began the submarine campaign, and along with it, I think that there was a lot of American resentment. I think that the people moved just as fast as the president did.
What kind of an impact did the famous Zimmerman telegram make in January?
Did what?
The Zimmerman telegram, when the Germans wrote to the Mexicans and says, yeah, if you will join us, we might give you territories in the United States.
I know what it was. It had considerable impact, I think, in this part of the country. I wouldn't try to judge anywhere else, but certainly there was still a lot of feeling here that the Germans might invade through Mexico. I don't know how they would have gotten there. They couldn't have actually moved any large number of troops in those days. They didn't have the capacity of doing it. But we didn't realize that.
Was the Zimmerman note much discussed here in Waco?
Yes, I think so. Not so much the note as the idea of what the Germans might do. It was a constant feeling that somehow or another Germany could get an army into Mexico or could develop the Mexicans into a real fighting force. I don't think there was any real possibility of doing, because Mexico was still badly divided themselves. But those days it seemed quite real that the possibility of an invasion from the south, and I think it had a good deal to do with the feeling here.
The war was no longer over there. Over here.
That's right. We felt that it might very well move across the Rio Grande right up into our country.
After the military camps were built, Mr. Pogue, what else happened there that you saw?
How
often were you out in that area of town, and what did you observe?
Well, I was out there every day during the summertime when I was working with the engineers. I was there every day. Frankly, I don't think that you recognize the changes that are taking place at the moment they're taking place near as much as you do later on. I'm sure I didn't. I saw them build buildings, and it didn't mean too much to me. I later saw the troops training, and that meant a whole lot more to me. I remember very well. I suppose that it was in 1917. Of seeing the whole division, that is the 32nd Division, from Wisconsin and Michigan, that was here, and they had a maneuver that took them out across the old Walker Crossing Bridge. I was out at that time on the hill. Well, I'd been hunting all night, sort of, I'd been doing, and it was morning, and well, I remember sitting up there on that hill and watching that division crossing that bridge, marching up there. It impressed me so greatly. I always see that picture. There was 20,000 men in that march. Of course, I didn't stay to see it all, but it was tremendously impressive to me, far more than the construction of those buildings out there.
What did that scene tell you about the community, about the nation, and about the world at that point?
Told me that we was going to whip the Germans. I think that's exactly what the people were feeling at that time. There wasn't any of this feeling we saw here recently in Vietnam, and we just fight in limited fight. We were in it, putting everything we had in it to bring it to an end as quick as we could, and we figured the only way to end it was to completely destroy the German military force.
How well did the people of Waco accept all of these strangers who suddenly came to town, connected with the military camps?
I think they accepted them wonderfully well, and I think it was because of that same spirit that they felt that we've got to do something. We've got to do it now, and we've got to, whatever inconvenience it causes, we've got to take it to bring this thing to an end. Now, there wasn't any such feeling during the Vietnam War. I don't know of anybody who felt there was any real pressure on them.
Any opposition to the war in Waco that you can recall?
Only some of the German people who felt that we were not being fair with Germany.
Now, they had felt earlier that the U.S. had not been neutral. What about after the declaration of war? What do you recall of their activities?
I don't recall of any of them. I don't recall any of them really engaging in any sabotage or anything of that kind, but there was some reluctance on their part to support the war effort, that is, to buy war bonds, which was one of the big things during World War I. Was
Liberty bonds.
Yes, liberty bonds, selling liberty bonds. And there was a reluctance on their part to buy any of them. And speakers would want to go into those communities, and they wouldn't welcome them. There was no violence in this part of the country that I can recall, but there was just a plain reluctance to back things on the part of a substantial group.
Now, there were new laws passed in Congress dealing with espionage and sedition and trading with the enemies. What do you recall of that in Waco?
I don't recall that it had any particular impact here. There was nobody who could trade with the enemy here. There just wasn't much opportunity for those laws to have very much effect in Central Texas, because you had to be on the seacoast or border or something other to pretty well to for those laws to apply to you in those days.
Were they discussed in high school and in college, though, in town?
No, I don't think so. I don't recall it. There was very little discussion of it. They were accepted with very little protest of any kind.
Mr. Pogue, we've been talking about how your interest in public affairs developed. You became, of course, directly involved in public affairs just after 1920. But what can you tell us concerning the overall impact of the war on your thinking and your interest in public affairs?
It probably didn't have as much effect as maybe as much as it should have. I find that so many of those big things, we don't understand them fully at the time they're taking place, and we wonder why they didn't have a greater impact on us at the time. And the reason is, of course, that we didn't appreciate the importance of what was taking place at the time. And I think that was very true. I think it was more true then than it is now, because we didn't have the media that we have today. We didn't get the information and reviews and so on that we get today.
How much did you know of Mr. Wilson's peace efforts at the end of the war?
We knew a good deal, but it was always, a week late. We'd get the old Reader's Digest, would have comments on it. That was the kind of thing that we got in those days about the efforts, and just as it is today, you look at one side, Senator Lodge would make a perfectly good case, just Senator Goldwater can today, of his views, and then you'd look on the other side and get another prejudiced presentation of views. They didn't do much better, I don't think, than they do today of being impartial, I think, as a matter of fact.
You and your family, though, continue to support Mr. Wilson.
Yes, that's right.
And his idea of the League of Nations?
Yes, I think so. Although I know that I question somewhat, and I know that our folks question somewhat the practicality of the thing. We admired the effort, but we wondered if it would work. We hoped it would, but we weren't at all sure that it would. I think I should say that we didn't follow Senator Lodge, but we had a whole lot of question about whether Mr. Wilson was going to be able to achieve what he was trying to achieve. We doubted his ability, in other words.
He was too idealistic?
Yes.